You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Barbara Kingsolver was a biologist before she ever began to write novels. In her latest book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life, she goes back to her roots and documents her family's year-long adventure of eating locally, that is, only eating locally grown foods. Her book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased to welcome Barbara Kingsolver back to my show today. Hi.
Hi, it's great to be back here.
And it feels odd talking to you about something other than your latest work of fiction.
Well, it's similar in many ways to every latest work of fiction, except that all of this really happened.
Well, what does eating locally actually entail? Did you set certain rules for yourself?
We tried not to make this about rules. We didn't want to write a book that would or do a project that would make us look heroic. We didn't want people to read this book and say, wow, they're amazing. I could never do that. What we really wanted to get across is that we're a pretty normal American family and that this really was very doable. We weren't puritanical about it. We decided after moving to our home in southwestern Virginia, that because it's a place that does produce food, it has rich valleys surrounding it, as you do here, we would try as hard as we could to get all of our vegetables, fruits, dairy, meats, and eggs from our own county.
Now, when I've spoken to you in the past, you were living in the Southwest. Why did you move from Tucson to Appalachia?
We had many reasons for moving. For me, it was coming home. I grew up in southern Appalachia and had always intended to return there to be closer to extended family. So we had many of the usual reasons for returning. But we also had mixed feelings about living in a place that is increasingly stressed by the pressures, the sort of overt pressures of global climate change that is running out of water.
It's a desert.
It's a desert, yes, and it's having the most severe droughts in its history now. And it's not just southern Arizona that's facing pressures. Actually, just about any American city functions basically like a space station. Every unit of food people eat must be shipped in from elsewhere and waste taken out. And so we really wanted to think more about engaging in our own local food shed.
But Arizona is close to one of the great growing centers of the world, California. So if you perhaps extended your you're grown locally a couple of hundred miles, you still could have lived within it, couldn't you?
Oh, sure. And certainly, eating locally is possible wherever you live. Certainly possible.
Well, a lot of cactus in
California.
In Tucson,
the last people who really did it well were the Hohokam and Pima Indians. But for us, since we were moving to the fertile hills of southwestern Virginia, that seemed like a good place for us to start.
Is it easy to eat locally if you live in one of the warmer states like Virginia rather than Maine or Minnesota?
You know, there's a fantastic local food scene in Vermont, in New Hampshire. Another misapprehension people have is that you can't do it in cities. Of course, we live in a rural place, but the picture is actually better if you live in New York City than if you live in a small town in Iowa that is surrounded by thousands of acres of corn monoculture. In this city, I just read that you have 114 city gardens. You have CSAs here, community-supported agriculture, and you have a lot of farmers markets. So the fastest-growing sector of the agricultural economy in the U.S. is small, diversified organic farms surrounding urban centers.
I think I read recently that we've actually reversed the trend toward abandoning farms in this area because of changing attitudes from, at least in the Hudson Valley. So that may be a positive sign. But you grew up in a farming community in Kentucky, although you've said you weren't farmers yourself. Was that a factor also in this experiment?
Yes, we grew a lot of our own food when I was growing up, and I came of age in a community of farmers. So I came into the world with a respect for the people who grow food, and it was kind of a shock to me to move out into a world where people don't think about the person who grew their food, don't know whether that person is in the U.S. or China, or whether indeed it was a person or a factory mixing the cheapest possible ingredients from three different continents. We, in the last couple of generations, have forgotten even how to think about where our food comes from. And that's really what we wanted to address in this book. We wanted to tell a story about food and where it comes from.
Now, your husband's also a biologist, a trained biologist.
Yes, he is. He teaches environmental science.
So was that something that, was that a factor as well? When you were eating food, as people who studied biology, did you think, gee, this strawberry that I'm eating right now in the wintertime that's coming from thousands of miles away has been biologically affected by that experience?
Well, we're really more inclined to think about biological cycles. Because we are both biologists, we understand the botany of food, the basic botany, what comes up after the snow recedes from the ground are green shoots and leaves. Asparagus and lettuce are things you could expect to find in a temperate climate in April and May. A watermelon, which is enormous fruit, the end of a long botanical cycle, I look at it as a biologist and say, this started its life 4 months ago. If I'm eating it in May, it's got some frequent flyer miles on it. I really wanted to make this an engaging story that would just help people learn how to think about food in this way.
How much did you know about farming? Because you seem to have produced tons of tomatoes, for
example.
Yeah,
we did. More tomatoes than we ever imagined. I was an experienced gardener. We all were. We've been growing gardens as long as we've been a family. And so for us, doing a lot of this ourselves was a pleasure, and it was something we put into the book, but it's not a how-to manual. It's really more a sort of a revelation. And I really enjoyed it as a writing challenge to make this informational story also a good page-turner.
My guest is Barbara Kingsolver, who has written with Stephen L. Hoppe, her husband, mm-hmm. and her older daughter, Camille Kingsolver, Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life. It is published by HarperCollins. I mentioned tomatoes because in Italy, sun-dried tomatoes are what they do to have tomatoes in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm. That's what we do, too.
And it's weird. In this country, you can have sun-dried tomatoes in the summertime.
Yeah, that were shipped to you from California.
But you say that you should get as much stuff when it's fresh and then do things like can it and boil it down or whatever, whether you live in the city or whether you're growing it in your garden.
Now, I want to correct you on that. I don't say you should do anything. I'm allergic to telling anybody they should do anything, and that's really not what this book is about. I can tell you what I did, and I can tell you why I did it and how much I enjoyed it. And I think it is important to remind people that wherever you live, if you can get things at the fresh market and do something, throw some tomatoes in your freezer or keep a bushel of apples in a cool closet or something and have some of this food in a later season, you're also doing a favor for that farmer, because that farmer has to live through the winter on what he or she earns in the summer. They can't put their tomatoes in the bank.
Because tomatoes don't have a very long life.
Although, they have a short shelf life.
Yeah. And when you refrigerate them the way we often do, we wind up with no flavor.
They're horrid. No. They should never go in the refrigerator.
Well, if you're lucky, you have them growing nearby and just take them when they're ripe and eat them at that moment.
Yes. And when you do, you begin to appreciate what a real tomato tastes like. These things that we get in January that have been shipped from heaven only knows where I call them the vegetable formerly known as tomato. They don't even have any flavor. And so you have to wonder what happened in the last couple of generations that we slowly began demanding and expecting to eat every vegetable in every season from any corner of the world, but we stopped caring that it all tastes like cardboard. If you begin to eat things in their season, you learn what they really taste like at their best, and you don't really need them at other times of the year because there's always something else.
Now, many people are confused about the differences between eating locally and eating organically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, you can eat locally without eating organically. You can eat organically without eating locally. But would you say the ideal is to eat locally organically?
Sure. There are two different things, two different good things. Obviously, local means from nearby. So when you spend your dollars locally, you're investing in your own local food economy. The money stays in your own school district. You're helping to keep green spaces alive around your city. And you're investing in the food security of your place. So those are all good things. And a lot of small diversified farmers who sell at markets are organic. Organic, of course, just means you don't put toxic chemical pesticides or herbicides on your crops and you don't use chemical fertilizers. That's also a good thing, but it can be done on an industrial scale, increasingly it is, to make food that is shipped to you from over hundreds or thousands of miles. So the organic part of that equation is good, of course, having even corporate farms take production out of pesticide dousing and put it into organic production is a good thing. But then you weigh the fossil fuel that's used in the packaging and the shipping, and that can be problematic. So I always start first with local, and I try to get everything as close to my home as I can. I try to get the miles per gallon out of my food. It's also important to remember that many farmers who do practice organic methods aren't certified because they can't afford the $700 a year it costs for that certification inspection process. Because in this country, we make organic farmers pay out of their pockets. We essentially punish organic farmers and reward the non-organic farmers.
And you say that's one of the reasons that organic food tends to be more expensive. People say, I'd love to eat better, but it's so much more expensive. Another is that it's a lot more labor-intensive, isn't it?
Well, it is. It takes a lot more labor to raise food organically. But if you buy something from the farmer himself, you can say, how did you grow this? What did you put on it? Often farmers will say, you know, come to my farm if you want to see. I value my soil fertility. I value my workers. I value my animals. I take good care of them, whether or not they're certified organic. If you have this direct connection with your food system, you can trust it. Now, the cost issue is very curious to me because people do often complain organic vegetables cost a little bit more. But here's a question. Where I live, I could buy a house for $50,000. In this city, you could, I think, probably spend that much on rent for a small apartment in 5 years or less. So why does anybody live in New York? Why don't you all come and live in my county? The answer is you pay for what's valuable to you. You live where you do. You buy the clothes you do. You consume what you do because it matters, because you care both about what it does for you and other people. We as a nation spend a lower proportion of our incomes on food than any other country in the world. This is something we could get over if we. Mistrust if we feel uneasy about this industrial pipeline that's delivering us cheap food. And if we are concerned about the legislation, the farm bill, the laws in this country that actually give billions of our tax dollars to support commodity agriculture that's making high fructose corn syrup and cheap burgers, if we'd rather some of that funding support vegetable and fruit farmers and organic methods, we could talk to our congresspeople. We could reverse this equation ourselves.
So there's a political thing as well.
Of course.
Something happened to farming in the United States after World War II, and it seemed to be promoting the agribusinesses over the small farmers.
Well,
Farm subsidies going to the small farmers as well?
Originally, they were. Around the time of the Depression, these subsidies were devised to help keep small family farms alive because that's essentially the only kind of farm there was. Little by little, these subsidies have been, and our farm policy has come under the control of large agribusinesses that produce primarily commodities, corn, wheat, and soybeans, rather than the fruits and vegetables that our Surgeon General tells us we should be eating more of.
And you say this transformation took place over just two generations. We had this long history that was different, but still isn't 80% of America still rural farmland?
But not 80% of our people. And, you know, this is referring to farms the size of Manhattan that grow corn, which is destined to become mostly corn syrup for soda pop.
Or a slop for pigs and for
right,
cows.
Right, which will become, right. So this transformation has occurred as we have as we've lost our own connections with where our food comes from and stopped paying attention. But this is clearly reversing. I'm seeing an incredible trend toward people believing they want to know something about where their food came from.
Well, you also suggest that we know the rules of basic food production, like which fruits and vegetables come in during which season.
Yeah.
So what happens if I have a craving for strawberries in the wintertime? Do I just resist that craving?
You can do whatever you want. You can eat the strawberries in January. You'll probably find they taste like water. But you'll probably also find, as you start paying attention to what's fresh in each season, you like what you have. That's absolutely what happened with my family. We went into this exercise thinking it would be an experiment in deprivation. It was the opposite. It was an exercise in gratitude. As each month unfolded, a new menu of ingredients we could choose from, we enjoyed it so much.
And you had no rough patches along the way?
Not particularly. I mean, we kind of devised new ways of thinking about food and new ways of cooking. Lots of simple, fresh, simple whole ingredients, simple recipes. And by the time the experiment ended, it was no longer an experiment. It was our life.
And everybody went along with it. Your 19-year-old daughter, Camille, contributes to your book with journal-like entries and recipes.
Mm-hmm.
But how old is Lily, your younger one?
Lily is now a fifth grader, so she was a third grader when we started the project.
Now, kids at that age are so prone to peer pressure. Everybody's going to the local McDonald's, and they want to go too.
Well, you know, I didn't forbid anything if there was a birthday party or something, but Lily's a great kid, and she actually has her own flock of chickens. She started a chicken business during this year and sells eggs to the neighborhood. And these are fresh eggs that come from her hens, which graze on open pastures, and the yolks are the color of a Crayola orange crayon. And she hears from her customers, "I'm never going back to the grocery store for eggs. Yours are the best." You know, this is profound feedback for her. She understands she's making something wonderful that's healthy, that people like better. She helps in the garden. She sees this whole process. I think it's the same if you take kids to a U-Pick operation or a farmer's market. Kids adore to get dirty, to get their hands into food. I think there's nothing really innate about loving gummy bears. I honestly don't.
You hypothesize that the reason kids today no longer believe in evolution may be related to their disassociation from natural processes like the evolution of plants. So are you saying that most farm kids are Darwinians?
I wouldn't say that. No, I only speculated kind of as an aside that as we become more and more dissociated from biological processes, we stop having this innate understanding of biological laws. When kids grew up on farms or around farms and saw that you apply a copy of natural selection to your herds, as you cull and you select for the strongest genes, they saw selection and change through time taking place. Now, kids don't see that. I do think farm kids are naturally, if you don't call them Darwinians, you just say they do understand natural selection. Now kids see, they go to college on campuses where the petunias are replaced in the night by marigolds, and they're replaced, you know, at the end of their life by geraniums. So they never even get to see the simple process of a flower becoming a fruit, becoming a seed. These processes in which we are embedded as animals, these biological laws that apply to us, we start to forget about when we live in a cement world where we've removed ourselves completely from biology. Here's the problem, though. These biological laws still do apply to us just as much as gravity does. So we ignore our food chain and our habitat to our peril. These problems are coming back to us now on an enormous scale.
I'm talking with Barbara Kingsolver about her latest book, Animal, Vegetable, Miracle, A Year of Food Life, published by HarperCollins. So you ate locally. There are people who have decided to only eat food that's produced with 150 miles of where they live. There are some chefs who've chosen that. Mm-hmm. Did you have something, a rule like that, or was it just, you know, not far?
Our only rule was do the best you can. It was pretty straightforward to get our vegetables, fruits, and meats from our own county. For grains, we had to go a bit farther afield, but we looked into sources. We found a mill that was, in our state. We found a dairy that does not use hormones in its milk or pesticides on its pastures, and it's about 120 miles away, but that was the best we could find. We'd love it if an organic dairy opened in our county, and we would move our business to that one, of course, but as it is, we're just doing our best, and I think that taking a step is much more important than concentrating on some sort of moral purity, because
Well, you didn't want to go visit friends for dinner and say you have to be cooking food.
No, of course not.
From local producers.
That would be rude. No, when friends invited us to dinner, we ate what they served us.
A listener writes, "I've been shopping at farmers markets for over 25 years. In the old days, it was less expensive than shopping in the grocery stores, based on the idea of eliminating the middleman. Over time, the farmers seem to have recognized that they're selling a premium product, and now it's more expensive than the stores. This is a dismaying trend in that it discourages people on limited budgets from eating local."
Well, I can tell you a few things about that. I can almost guarantee you that the farmers are not making a killing. It is getting more and more difficult rather than easier for farmers to make ends meet because farm policy in this country drastically favors agribusiness over the small producer.
And is that only in this country? Because you don't see the same sorts of things happening in Europe, or maybe it's starting to happen there.
Europe has its problems too, but Europeans value their local food systems. It's a form of patriotism in Italy and France to celebrate your local product. This is what's missing here, and as these farmers struggle to compete with the ocean of cheap fats and carbohydrates that flood our grocery stores, our fast food chains, even our kids' school lunch programs, that's the trouble. So this is actually a very good time to be thinking about that, because the Farm Bill, which sets these policies, is renegotiated every 5 to 7 years, and right now it's being renegotiated. So if you care, you could let your congressperson know that you do.
If you're thinking of going to some town in France, you're always told, well, Saturday is the day of the market, or Tuesday or Thursday, whatever. People are very proud of those markets. Mm-hmm. We have a great green market here, although I would prefer seeing it look a little more like some of the ones I've seen in Europe, mm-hmm. but it's still terrific. Mm-hmm. Are there farmers markets in your area? Is this something that you mentioned there's a problem in Iowa where everything is corn. Would there be a local farmers market?
Oh, there, of course, are farmers markets in Iowa. There are on average 75 farmers markets per state in the U.S. And, of course, they're not evenly distributed. There are more of them here, for example, than probably in Iowa. But there are plenty. And there is another one opening every week. farmers markets are a growing trend. And to refer back to the person who wrote in this discouraging trend of prices going up, this is something we can assist with, because if we choose to direct more of our food dollar to these farmers who are, frankly, struggling to get their produce into the cities, it will reward them. It will give them a little bit better advantage with the economies of scale. And policy surely will also shift a bit more in their favor. And for those of us who have some choices about how we spend our food dollars, if we do invest in our local food economies, it broadens it so that it's available. It's more available to people who don't now have access to fresh local produce.
So when you were doing all of the canning and the boiling of tomatoes and all the other things that you were putting away for the wintertime, mm-hmm. were you able to still continue to write?
Writing is my day job. I'm at my desk 8 to 5 and longer, and I wish I were always writing. I'm often, you know, answering the phone and doing other things, going on book tour, you know, other stuff.
You make me feel guilty.
Oh, no, it's delightful. But that's my job, and I'm a working mother, like so many other people I know. The job is what anchors my time, and the evenings and weekends are when I get to do what I want. I've made a choice that cooking and making food for my family is something I want to do. I enjoy it. The big canning extravaganzas at the end of summer were really, that's kind of like the World Series of gardening. It's a big push, but it's I would do that on a couple or three Saturdays in August. I always invite a bunch of girlfriends over, so we do it together. It's, you know, we chat all day. It's like a book club with benefits.
And you suggest that it lasts long enough so that by the time the tomatoes come in for the next year, you've just finished off all the stuff that you put away.
Yeah, that's pretty much how we plan it. We put up enough tomatoes that they hold us through the winter. And, you know, of course, most people can't do that, but you can freeze things. You can put at least something by. Anybody can do that. I know that, you know, I have friends in cities who say, well, now for Homeland Security and whatever, they're saying we should have food on hand in our closets. And I'm thinking, well, why not make it local? Why not throw some local produce in your freezer? It will still be local in February.
And you can be patriotic, you're saying.
Exactly. Well, and feel safe.
Now, you talked about the problems of book tours because they take you away from the
more important... Oh, did I say problems? Oh, no.
They take you away from what you really want to do. Are you going to be...
I really want to be here.
Are you going to be at another book tour soon with a new novel?
First I'll have to go home and finish it. But yes, I'm working on a novel. That will be the next.
Well, I remember the first time we talked, mm-hmm. your first novel, you had to complete by the time you gave birth to Camille, I guess it was.
Yeah,
and
I wrote
so
it while
you
I was
finished
pregnant.
It. You said you finished it about an hour or two before you went into labor.
Pretty much, yeah. They talk about that mad fit of cleaning, house cleaning you have before you give birth. In my case, it was this pile of papers on my desk. I said, "Oh, I'm going to send this off to New York," and I did. And wow, look what happened!
I want to thank you so much for being with us. The book, Animal Vegetable Miracle: A Year of Food Life, from Barbara Kingsolver, with Stephen L. Hoppe and Camille Kingsolver. I hope you didn't fight too much about what went in here.
Not at all. We loved co-authoring. It was really, really fun. Although they left it to me to make it a page turner. That was my job.
The book is published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us again.
You're welcome.